good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is Thursday, April the 6th, 2017, 1:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. About, 46 minutes left with you today, and we're having a good time here. No answer to the trivia question, so I hope somebody calls in, 740-383-9944. And unfortunately, I have not heard back from Heloise yet, and I went back and looked at the email to make sure that I had the date and the time correct. And I did, and you know, about 3 weeks ago, we had very similar trouble to this, trying to get a hold of Heloise. And it was my fault at that point. We were having phone problems here at the station. I don't think we're having those today. As far as I know, the phones are working. If somebody wants to give me a call to check the phones, feel free. 740-383-9944. But Adam, the computer guy, got in there, so I'm going to assume the phones are working. 740-383-9944. And again, we have all these trivia questions for you. And I have to think somebody out there knows the answer, because we would love to give away a To Die For cupcake or two free bowling games to Buckeye Lanes. Now, I'm going to run through these trivia questions again, because somebody has to know. Somebody has to know the answers to some of these. A Dorothy Fulltime, legendary WEWS television personality, worked into her 90s. She had a stroke that ended her television career, I believe, when she was 92 years old. The day that she had that stroke, she taped her last interview. Her last interview was with probably the most famous person in the world in 1983. Whom was her last interview with? Hey, you're on the air. Go ahead.
This is Heloise calling.
Oh, there we go. Perfect. Heloise, how are you?
Well, I'm a little horsey today, or froggy, even though I live in sunny San Antonio, where it's normally warm. We had an unusual cold front come through, and it brings, it's unique to Texas and San Antonio. We call it cedar fever, and it's really the mountain juniper tree, which blossom all over Texas and part of the West, and when a cold front comes through, it unlike most allergies that come in the spring, this can start in October, November, and run all the way through the end of March. So people who don't know think they have a cold, and your eyes itch, and your nose runs, and you're going anyway, so as long as you don't mind listening to me do I'll cover the phone, I would love to be on the air with you.
I am glad that you are on the air with us today, because your career is so fascinating. Your mother's career, absolutely fascinating, the first Heloise, all the interesting, helpful hints that have come over radio and newspaper columns and magazines for so many years. And it's great to have you on, and I was, somebody did ask me a question this morning, so I do want to get that question out here.
Certainly.
Because when they heard that Heloise was going to be on, I thought it was a really prescient and very interesting question.
Uh-oh.
And I'm sure it comes up a lot. How to address cell phones at the table for family dinners. Yeah. Especially when eating out. The full question is this. How to address cell phones at the table for family dinners, especially when eating out. Mm-hmm. It's a new trend I see everywhere. I have been guilty too. Mm-hmm. It is rude now that it seems everyone does it, even parents, and that's from Shelley here in Marion.
This is, and Shelley, you are spot on, as the Brits say. And this is a new trend or dilemma, whichever way you want to look at it. And cell phones enhance our lives, safety, etc. But they also can be a detriment. And Peggy Post, the great-granddaughter-in-law of the original Emily Post, is a close friend of mine. And we've had this discussion, etiquette-wise, business-wise, family-wise. And I've even addressed it in my newspaper column. And what we concluded with our readers from the newspaper column is that if the family sits down at the table and eats together, no cell phones, not on your lap because you're looking down texting. Now, if somebody is in the hospital, if somebody's expecting a baby, you're expecting an emergency call, that's different. They can go on the sideboard. I know CEOs and executives who have said, when we have a meeting, your cell phone goes on the side table. I am not going to sit in this meeting and have you pretending that you're making notes and you're checking text. Now, eating out is a whole different thing. You know, the whole point is they have the right to do what they wish. If you're eating out with your family and you say, okay, no cell phones, either turn them off, put them on vibrate, set it in your lap. If you're expecting an important call, we're here as a family to eat. Now, the other side of that is yesterday, my husband and I went to, there's a local diner here that's based on a New York, really, diner. Well, honey, it was so loud. We're sitting at a booth across from each other. I couldn't hear him, and he couldn't hear me. All right. If that's the case, okay, go ahead and text if that's what you need to do. But I personally, particularly business-wise and personally, in fact, another reader letter, and this is what started the conversation in the office, and she said, my girlfriend and I only see each other, I think it was like three times a year. They try to have lunch three times a year and catch up on everything. And she said the last two times, she's either been on her cell phone texting or she's kind of looking at me and looking down at the text. And then you can see her thumb moving. And she said, I finally said, I'm not going to have lunch with you anymore. You're and I are supposed to be talking. We're supposed to, right? We don't get to see each other. Now, again, and the interesting and kind of scary part is I have spoken to psychiatrists, psychologists, behavior specialists. They are very concerned that the millennials and others that are so attached to their cell phones that they'll be in the same room and text somebody, that they may not even be able to, if you talk to them face-to-face, they may not even be able to read or disconcern facial cues. You know, when you say something to somebody and they kind of frown, like, oh, come on, you get the drift, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Or you say something to somebody and their eyebrows go up. That means, like, wow, okay. These people may not be able to read those. So family-wise, it's your family. And give it a test. You know, they'll and you watch the ones that are really attached. In fact, there's sort of like a new phenomenon. They did some testing on, and I don't remember the age group, but my guess would be millennials and younger, or kids that have grown up with cell phones, and that's the way they communicate. And took them away for like 4 to 5 hours, and wired them, and these people were actually reacting almost like a panic attack because they didn't have their cell phone.
You know what's interesting? I was shocked because when I went to college, I went to college to be a teacher. That's actually what my degree's in, is education. And when I was in school, nobody had a cell phone.
No.
But when I went back and taught, something had happened. And cell phones were there, but they were, you know, okay, keep them in your locker, so on and so forth.
Right.
Then it got to the point where I was not teaching anymore, but I would go back and sub every so often because it is something I enjoy.
Sure.
And when I would go back and sub, a lot of the schools, they can be at your desk. They can, as a matter of fact, they a lot of them prefer it because they're sending homework assignments.
Yes.
On them.
Yes.
So I can see why. I don't think it's so much that people are waiting for a phone call or a text and that's why they get jittery. Their life is tied to this thing.
Yes. And And I agree with you. And by the way, that's one of the things that we do have in common is I have a teacher's certificate, and I was going to be teaching math. One of my former employees, in fact, Anna, was a teacher, and now she does tutoring. And she talked about the cell phone dilemma, and she said, yes, you know, it's different today because we may send them texts, we may send their homework, that's how we contact with their parents, etc. However, she said, I explained to them that when you're in my class and I'm at the board or I'm talking to you, you better be paying attention to me. And trust me, I will know. Now, here's when you know you have an addiction. There are usually young girls, this is true, okay, who will put the cell phone in a zip bag so they can take it in the shower with them.
My goodness.
Do we think that's a little much?
How do they sleep?
I looked at, again, one of my employees, I said, now, come on, you're making this up. And she's like, no. So my daughter, no. But her friends, yes. And I said, and then the other thing, what you just said, too, is that their lives are all in that cell phone. Banking, financial, phone numbers, you know, contact photos. So it is important to them. That I can understand that. And as here's a quick Heloise hint also. I'm getting ready to do a full column on this, is if everything is in your cell phone and you have precious photos, you better darn sure download them. Because what happens if your phone crashes or, as they say politely, goes missing?
Well, you know, it's emails, because nobody mails a letter anymore, unfortunately.
Yes, they do.
Well, I'll wait for one, Heloise. I'll wait for a letter.
Then you send me your station address, dear heart. I actually write letters. And let me point out, for those listeners here, a handwritten note, card, or letter today carries more weight than it did 30 years ago. Because just like you said, well, I don't get any letters. So what happens when you do? Aren't you excited?
Well, and the thing for me is, we are in Marion, Ohio, which is the town President Warren G. Harding was born in. And so much information and so much has been known about him that we never would have known.
Yes.
Because of letters he wrote.
Yes.
He was an excessive letter writer.
Yes.
And what are we going, you know, President Trump in 40, 50, 60, 70 years, will he have written anything? There was a story yesterday that the tweets are going in the National Archive.
Yes.
Is that it?
Well, but you have to, and you're right about the Harding letters and going back. And it's new technology. When the telephone, when they first were going to try to promote the telephone, they decided that it was going to be for commerce and business and things. And so they put some in homes, and half the people said, well, why would I pick up this instrument and call someone that's two blocks away when I can just walk down and say hello? Or in those days, I send a note. Well, they found out that it was, and this was the time, mind you, it was the housewives who were gossiping and talking to each other. It wasn't necessarily the kind of communication that they thought it would be for. So texting and tweets today are the equivalent of that. And whether you, I stay totally out of politics, but the fact is, yes, they should go in, because if he's not writing and you're not writing letters, that's his form of communication. And that's the form of communication today.
You know, Heloise, there was and this is not political, so I don't want people to take this in a political way, but it was a fascinating story on Inauguration Day, because the National First Lady's Museum is in Ohio.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah, and
excuse me.
Yeah, and something, there was a big story at that time, right before President Trump was inaugurated, that, you know, for good or for bad, whether people like Donald Trump's tweets or think they're silly or they're important, they're going in the National Archive. Well, the First Lady's Museum was asked a question about Melania Trump's nude photographs. And they said, yes, we would take them because they are part of her history. And they took a lot of flack over that. Now, is that like a tweet? Do you say anything associated? Because Harding's letters, some of them have to do with his mistresses.
Yes, yes.
So do you put the nude picture in there? Or is that considered political? Or will anybody care 100 years from now?
I have no idea. That's a question that I think we will all ponder for a long time. But your point should be well taken and thought of, excuse me, that without the Harding letters that have come to light, that the way I understand it, the family finally agreed it was okay, correct?
Well, it's actually a little more deep than that, but the letters were embargoed. The family knew what was in the letters, I assume.
Right.
So they embargoed them for 80 years, I think it was.
Yes.
And the idea was the people living then would all be dead when they came out. So what ended up happening, we had this all happened on this show, a matter of fact. So I know a lot about this.
Okay.
What happened was they were kept in the Ohio Historical Society. The letters were found here in Marion. Then the Harding family got word that there was some salacious material in there. So they got them embargoed. And they were sent to the Ohio Historical Society. Well, they were there for about 10 years, and somebody got the idea that they might be safer at the National Archive. So the guy working in the maintenance department thought that maybe that was a trick, and that, you know, they would get lost on the way to the National Archive, because there was salacious material in there.
Yes.
A magazine tried, I think it was Harper's Bazaar, tried to publish them back in the 50s or something like that. So the guy who worked in the maintenance room made copies of all the letters. Now, even though it was illegal, he did it.
Yeah.
So they...
But my understanding from what you're telling me is he did it for the right reason.
He had good intentions.
He had good intentions,
yeah. So the letters go off to the National Archive to be embargoed, and this guy gets rather old, about 2008. And he's, you know, getting on in years. I don't think he was ill or anything, but he had these all these years. The letters were embargoed, I think, through 2014. So what he ended up doing, 2015. So what he ended up doing was he gave the letters to a lawyer in Cincinnati named Jim Robinault. And Jim found out that the way the embargo was written in the 60s, it did not cover the copies because they didn't know there were copies.
Oh, my Lord.
And that's how they got published.
Oh, my heavens. Meaning published early.
Published early, yes. About 5 years early.
Well, and so I really, it's an old. But to your point, for your listeners and for my readers, is, and I have written this and said this many times, and I do it. I do a lot of speaking to civic groups and town halls and business organizations, and I try to explain to them. I say, now look, you know, most of us do everything by email. We do text, you know, even business and all that thing, that kind of stuff. However, to send a thank you note or dick note to your grandmother or your mother or your aunt or your uncle or your best friend. Okay. Well, I can print it out. Well, you print it out, but it's on a piece of paper. So to your point, so 50 years from now, you're going to go back and look at a piece of paper, and it's typed. And I just, as a matter of fact, I just found, and this is, I'm going to get a little personal here, but my father was an Air Force pilot. And he and my mother, the original Heloise, after the war, after 1945, after the war ended, they were stationed in China and then got evacuated to Japan. And I have found, just going through some things a little bit at a time, Now, this is one of my mother's hints. Now, she was not Heloise at the time. She didn't start being Heloise really until 1959 or 1960. But my brother, apparently it's from China or Japan, and it's one of his school little artwork papers, you know, with the pencils and crayon and thing. Daddy, on the back of it, wrote a note or a letter to his in-laws. Dear A and Bowles, we're doing fine in China, something or other, you know, food is scarce, I hunt pheasant, you know, things like that. Lewis is doing okay in school, he found a little dog. Well, I found that. Okay, that's his artwork when he was 7 or 8 years old, and a handwritten note from my father. Those are the things that are going to be missing. And indeed, I was up, you know, I had a radio show years ago. In fact, I'm going to be back on the air soon. I'm doing vignettes now. But I did a show from the Smithsonian, down in the bowels of the Smithsonian, and was interviewing and talking to the archivist. And this was 10 years ago. And they were talking about technology and saying, you know, VHS tape. People have boxes. They keep asking, of VHS tapes. Very few people have a VHS player. So their suggestion, and also from a technology guru out in Silicon Valley, was that, like, is that supposedly every 10 to 15 years, or when a new technology comes along that everyone's using, you're supposed to transfer all of your photos. How many photos do you have on DVDs or backed up on your computer? And that kind of thing. And I looked at him and I said, that sounds good in theory. I can't tell my readers. Do you know how much that would cost them? So their concern, even at the Smithsonian, was, just like you said, that in 100 years, will there be any photos to go back and look at? Unless you print them out.
Well,
if you print them out, you better print them out on the right photo paper. So it's really kind of scary, but it's life.
And it's interesting because something that hit me the other day, because because I don't have any helpful hints, so this is not advice from me. But somebody said a similar thing to me, because I have a lot of VHS things from interviews from years past and cassette tapes. And they said the same thing, that, you know, you probably want to do something with those because that is going to not be there pretty soon. Mm-hmm. But then, not too long after somebody had said that to me, somebody found a bunch of old kinescopes in somebody's house, and they still worked.
Yes.
Now, they told those kinescope people, they said, this is the worst form of doing anything, and you'll be lucky if these things will be around in 5 years.
Yeah.
And here we are 70 years later, and people are still watching those.
Now, that's true, but the dilemma is do we have the technology to play that? See, I have, now here's, Scott, remember we don't talk politics, but we were talking about my mother and the people she knew.
Absolutely.
And, how between me and my mother, we have met directly or for one degree of separation every president up to Obama, including President Eisenhower. I met President Eisenhower. I had found, I have a wine cellar that, frankly, is now storage. There's no wine in there. But it stays 55 to 60 degrees. And the humidity is like 70. I check it about once a month. And I've started putting a lot of mother's things in there. Well, I found the large metal film can. and I can see her handwriting on it. And it says something Austin, Texas, and I'm not sure if it's got the year on there. I probably have a photo of it. Well, I also found photos of my mother with John Connally, and it's after the assassination because he's got his arm in a sling, the Kennedy assassination. And it's they're in cocktail. He's in a tux. She's in a cocktail dress. It looks like they're at a theater. And she wrote on it, John Connally, after the Kennedy assassination.
He was the governor of Texas who was in the car.
Governor of Texas that was in the same limousine, and one of the bullets went through him. And so I looked at that, and I kind of put the two together. Now, I have not opened it because I know not to open it. And I called my sister-in-law, and I said, do you remember Mother? Because at that time, we lived in D.C. We lived in D.C., 62 through 66. And she said, I remember your mother going to Texas for some event, some newspaper event or something. So that must have been it. So I'm, and knowing my mother, because this is a big reel. And in those days, remember, the TV stations would come and film a whole bunch of stuff. Then they would have to go back to the station and edit it to be put on the air. Knowing my mother, this is raw footage because it's heavy, but I've not opened it because I know not to. So the question is, who do I give this to, or who has the capability to open it, preserve it, and see what it is?
That's tough.
I know.
Well, you know, and it comes back to the whole idea again. I don't know how many Kinescope players there are, and I don't know, do they play them on Kinescope machines that existed then? I think they've created some, they've had to have, I would think. Because I can't imagine that any of those would still be operational.
Well, possibly if I'm a member of, AFTRSAC, American Federation of Television, Radio, and Screen Actors Guild. Don't ask me why Screen Actors Guild. I was in one movie. The Museum of Radio and Television in New York, and if you ever get a chance, it is worth going. You can go sit and watch old Jackie Gleason shows. Their archives is phenomenal, and they're getting new things every day. They have, from my understanding, all of the equipment. In fact, remember about 10 or 15, 20 years ago that they called them, I think they called them the Lost Lucy tapes?
Oh, yeah.
And it was the tape, the reel-to-reel, the big metal can that they found in somebody, either it was under his bed or in his closet, that had worked on the show or something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, in the biz, what's interesting about that, now exactly what you said, when they were starting to do the I Love Lucy show, all of those shows were live, and they were taped. Was it Kinescope?
I think I know where you're going, and from my understanding, from having Lucille Ball's secretary on one time,
yes,
was that nobody was taping shows back then because that myth was around that Kinescope was junk and wouldn't last 5 years. So they paid extra, but
yes,
they used film.
Yes, that's what it was.
Yeah.
That Desi Arnaz negotiated with them, and they filmed it. And that's why we now have those shows.
And they look so good.
Yes.
And, like, if you see, because Lucy was the most popular, but a person who's been forgotten, and I honestly think it has to do with quality, because Lucy's been gone nearly 30 years now. Lucy's shows look so good. And, yes, the quality is one of the reasons they hold up. But also of that time, right there, the most popular man in radio and the most popular man on television was probably Jack Benny.
Yes.
But Jack Benny's shows, a lot of them were not filmed, and most of them were kinescope. Now, they exist, but the quality is not great.
No.
And I think that's why they don't play those with the fervence that they do of the Lucy shows.
Well, I think, and I think you're right, and as a member of, you know, after SAG, there's a big push from that industry to help, to fund, to donate money to the organization to restore many, many of the world-famous movies that are in their vaults and that are deteriorating. So I think the lesson here for your listeners and my readers and things is if you have a VHS of your wedding, you know, your daughter's bat mitzvah or something that you really cherish, go have that transferred. The VHS of our wedding, 36 years ago, by the way, is in my safe, which is temperature controlled. Not temperature controlled, but it stays cool. And I kept, and I thought, you know what? I need to, I played it. It was fine. And I thought, I know better. I better go have this transferred. So if you've got some of those, and it's very inexpensive now, and you'll have that factor of comfort, and the fear will be gone, and you'll be able to pass it on to future generations.
Absolutely. We're talking with the legendary Heloise. Heloise, in the last 15 minutes, there are two subjects I want to cover. I want to get to the presidents here momentarily, but one thing left on this idea where we started of technology. One thing that fascinates me, and I think you know the reason or the answer to one of these questions, being in the business, but the other one I have no idea about. Why was it, and you alluded to it earlier, that newspapers and telephones and letter writing were the first big forms of communication. And then here comes television, which was far and away number one.
We had radio.
Radio is the one I want to leave out because that's the other question.
Oh, okay.
But here came television, and it immediately became number one in the 50s when it came to fruition on the network. Then, but it didn't wipe out. People were still writing letters, 50s, 60s, 70s. Newspapers were still had good circulation. People were still doing everything that they had done before, calling people on the telephone.
Yes.
The internet killed all those almost indefinitely, and including television. Now, not radio. Now, that's the other question. I think you know the reason radio, I believe, has survived. I know the answer to that one is because it's the only one you don't do with your eyes.
I think it's different.
You do? Okay.
I do. Because it's going back. Okay, there were pamphlets, then newspapers, and newspapers were the form of communications. It's how you got your news. Then we progressed radio. People in the old days, the whole family would sit around the radio in the parlor or the den and listen to the radio shows, the radio programs, as they called them. That was communication, particularly for people who lived not in major cities. Newspapers, you still got the morning paper, the afternoon paper. That's how you got your news. It wasn't instant. Then when television came along, everybody said, oh, radio, yeah, radio's dead. Who wants to just listen when you can watch? Radio's dead. Well, new form of technology that comes along, they say that. Now, the question is, possibly so, but how long? And I really found one of my trade papers. It was talking about my complaint. I love the internet. It's fabulous and everything. However, and please listen to me carefully, this is a hint from Heloise. One, everything is not on the internet. Just because you look for it and it's not there doesn't mean it's not available. Two, probably half of the stuff you read on the internet is not true or valid. People send me hints that they've gotten from somebody's Bouncing Betty's website or, you know, Harriet's Hummingbird site. Well, Heloise, you're wrong. According to this site, blah, 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 blah. Well, the information is incorrect. I go to the Audubon Society, to the Hummingbird Association, to the avian specialist. So a lot of the information out there, here's the funny one. Scott, you're going to love this one. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So a reader challenged me on a question, because I said it's about butter and margarine and how long does it last in the refrigerator. And you can freeze butter and you can freeze margarine. However, there's one or two brands that actually say on the label, do not freeze. Well, this reader challenged me. Well, here's a quote. She was quoting me to me. Somebody had taken my quote from my column and put it on their website without my name on it. So this woman went to, I don't know, whatever website, some cooking site. And there it says, you can freeze butter and margarine. So she is quoting me to me. And I very rarely have time to email back because I probably get 500 emails a day. But this one, I just couldn't resist. And I, you know, said, thanks for the email. FYI, that quote is from me. But here's the update. That is from a column probably 4 to 5 years old. Mm. The update that I have checked with the American Dairy Society, the manufacturer of these two different brands, the FDA, is there are some margarines that say do not freeze. Now, their viewpoint is, yes, it is probably freezable, and you can thaw it, but the quality will not be the same. So even with all that info, oh, here's one. Okay, I'm probably going to get in trouble here, but I know my facts. How many of y'all use flushable wipes? A lot of people. It's a big market, right? Okay. It says on the packaging, flushable. You talk to anybody in waste management, even here in San Antonio, it's costing them more than $1 million a year to unclog the sewer systems. Because, now, technically, the wipe is flushable. It will go through the toilet. My husband's a retired plumbing, heating, air conditioning contractor. I know people get icky about talking about this, but this is life, and this is what I do. All right. You can it'll flush and go through the toilet. Okay? That's flushable. It doesn't say anything about biodegradable. So once it goes through the toilet and into the plumbing system, and then through there, it clogs up their plumbing system. Millions of dollars a year across the country. So when, again, I get flack from readers, well, I'm reading the package. It says flushable. Well, technically, it is flushable. But you talk to anybody at your waste management, your sewer company, et cetera, where do you think it goes then? And something like 25%, and Ohio, you know, you all probably, something like 25% of the country is on non-municipal waste water. They're on septic systems. I am, where we live in semi-country, right? So if you live on, if you have a septic system for your home, that wipe may be flushable, but where does it go? Into your septic system. And it's not going to break down. Well, it may in 100 years. Excuse me. It may in 100 years. So this is what I do, is I may spend a half a day, waste management engineers, and in three different cities, you know, talk to government agencies, and then I randomly pick Warren, Ohio, Birmingham, Alabama, Seattle, Washington, and call them, see what they say. And generally, they're all on the same page. But so please, please, the old saying is, consider the source.
Here is my hint on that. In 100 years, when you're sitting around reading those tweets and emails, your septic system will probably be flushing out. So there's a date, 100 years from now. It'll be a big day, 100 years from now, when that all happens. We'll be cleaned out.
You know what? You're right. The septic systems will all explode.
It'll be so big. I mean, that'll be front page of your tweet and your whatever you have there at that point, Facebook or whatever. Eloise, with 5 minutes left, and we'll have to have you back to do the presidents and bigger. But not politically. So divorce all politics from this. But every president from Eisenhower to Obama, for non-political reasons.
Absolutely.
Who'd you like the best and why?
Well, I can't really answer that because when I was a little girl, when I was, we were in Washington, 58, no, that was Hawaii. So we were in Washington, 1950, I think, 54 through 58. I was born cross-eyed and had a surgery here in San Antonio, but also when we moved to D.C., I had one or two surgeries out at Walter Reed, the Army Hospital. And apparently, and I must have been six or seven, because I remember that last surgery, probably seven, President Eisenhower was in office. Well, the presidents go to Walter Reed for their checkups and things. And I was out. My parents had taken me out for a checkup. And Mother had me dressed up, you know, the little dress and the Mary Janes and the socks and the whole thing, the ribbons in the hair. And I had a big patch over the one eye. They would do one eye at a time. And Walter Reed is a military hospital, okay? So it's not like hospitals today. You know, it's not glamorous and it's utilitarian and awful paint and the whole thing. But there was a pillar in the middle of the waiting room, and I was apparently going around it. And, again, this is back then. They didn't have heavy security if the president got in. And apparently I literally ran into President Eisenhower. And the whole room went, and my father stood up, the colonel, and he bent down to me, and I vaguely remember this because I only had one eye that I could see, and said something like, well, aren't you a pretty little girl? What happened? And I said, you know, oh, well, they operated on my eye. And that was it. Now, my mother, the original Heloise, had met Nixon, President Johnson. I have met Lady Bird several times here in Texas at functions. And then going forward, and Nancy Reagan. And then I met Betty Ford, so there's a second one. And then, you know, non-political, but also because I had more contact with them, would be the Carters. I met President Carter and his wife in Atlanta. I was on book tour, and I see this TV station. And in the little break room, you know, where they have one or two little tables and a vending machine and everything, I went in to get a soda or something, and there is President Carter and Mrs. Carter sitting at the table having a coffee or something. Well, I know military etiquette and security and things like that. You don't just walk up and say hi. And, of course, I wanted to. And I kind of smiled, and it was like, aren't you Heloise? And so we chatted a little bit, and they were so nice. And this is what I'd like to, politics aside, is they picked up all of their stuff and put it in the trash can. Mm. Now, there were agents there that normally do that. And then through the years when I was in Atlanta, I would call and say hi and chat with them. So that was really a friendly relationship. And then Miss Clinton, I met at a speech up there, and then Mrs. Gore, something down here in San Antonio at a newspaper function. And so it's a good trivia joke, because people will say, well, you're not old enough to have met Eisenhower. Yes, I was. I was 7 years old.
you know what's interesting about that? It seems there are certain presidents and first ladies who, because of their maybe age when they went into office, they don't have that much time out of office, mm-hmm. or because they stay very active politically doing other things, that they're always in the spotlight. But the three names you mentioned there, Jimmy, Rosalynn Carter, and Lady Bird Johnson, what I have always heard, and when I talk to people, this is a little funny side note, and I'll try to get it in quickly, but Lady Bird lived to be, I think, 96. But she had a stroke, and the last few years of her life, she could no longer talk. I mean, that was public knowledge, but yeah. That's what happened. A lot happens to a lot of 90-year-olds. But I was in radio, and one time I thought, boy, wouldn't she be a great guest to have on? Now, it was just after one of the strokes. I was able to get to her house, not visit her house, but by telephone to her house. That's how accessible... Yeah. Yes. This was, because she was a former First Lady of the United States, but I think the circumstances under which her husband became president and how long he had been dead and how long she had lived, and the same thing with the Carters, it's been 40 years since he's been president almost, that not that time has forgotten them, but they just didn't stay active politically, and they became regular people again. Not that the people aren't regular, but they became accessible.
And I agree with you. And it really, and the Bushes, I met President Bush 41 when he was running for governor on a TV show, as a matter of fact, in Dallas with Mrs. Bush, Barbara Bush. And it's a really funny story, because she was promoting the book, because I was on book tour. She was promoting the book about Millie the dog, and Jack Hanna was on the show, and he had the most gorgeous animal I've ever seen up close. It was a black leopard, all right, a black leopard. And after the show, and again, you understand green room etiquette, if somebody's in their dressing room and the door is closed, you don't fawn and all that kind of stuff. So I don't ask for pictures. I just don't. If somebody asks me, of course. So I went to him and I said, can I get a picture with that cat? I mean, that is the most gorgeous cat. And he said, yes. Well, Mrs. Bush came over and said, well, I want one too. Well, her son, George Bush, came over, and she pushed him aside and said, wait a minute, this is me, Heloise and the cat, you have to wait. And I was like, and then when he became president, I'm thinking, she's still his mother.
You know, that's funny. I remember, one of the things I remember when Barbara Bush, when she became First Lady, do you remember those newspaper stories that it's a real person in the office again?
Yes.
Nothing bad about the people before.
No.
But it was just, they felt, this was a woman who would get down on her hands and knees and garden, and she was a little overweight. She was America.
She was America.
Her hair was white. You know, it was a whole, I can't remember if there were any white-haired first ladies before Barbara Bush.
Well, there may have been, but we would probably never know.
We would. And that is a good way to end. Heloise, it's always a tremendous pleasure to have you on, and people can find you all over the place on the internet. And back on radio soon, which is going to be a lot of fun, and hopefully back here very soon.
Yes, and I'll tell you what, I will hunt around for some of those photos, the ones of me in the bushes with the leopard, and possibly if I can locate the one of the film that God knows what's in there, that I'll post up on my website.
Perfect, and anything with Lady Bird, I think, would be interesting.
And anything with Lady Bird.
Beautiful.
Okay.
Beautiful. And we'll link that to our website. So, Heloise, As always, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And you have a wonderful day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that's all the time we have today. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Licensed, bonded, and insured is a proud supporter of WWGH Radio.